Today, the RLS boys offer another Bring Your Own Topic Day. Eric begins by discussing how long-term care insurance options should be evaluated. He explains how you should use the same powerful mathematics routinely used by investment analysts. Adrian then delves into five of the most common money mindsets, those core ways of relating to money that shape all your earning, saving, spending, and giving behaviors, as well as your contentment. Finally, Roshan considers the possible effects on the global economy if, for trade purposes, China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and others successfully shift away from the US dollar and toward the Chinese yuan. Stay tuned as we discuss all this and more right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Lungani, here with the entire gang back together, Eric Olson and Adrian Nicholson. We're ready for a great episode. We have all brought topics to discuss today, and we're going to review them with you and see how relevant and important they are. I noticed we're all three matching for those of you on the YouTube today, watching us on YouTube. So, Eric, welcome back. How was your conference?
The conference was fantastic. I'll talk about that more maybe at the end of the episode if we have a little surplus time. But it is, isn't it interesting? Yeah, that sort of financial advisor uniform vibe going on, navy blazers and blue shirts. What a, without coordination, just look at, we gravitate to that.
Yeah, we did. Adrian, how are you doing? Back for another episode. How was your week?
My week's been good. I'm feeling really good. I accomplished a pretty big workout that I planned out back in February. My goal was to go to the gym 7 days a week, and then the week after that, six. And 5, 4, 3, 2, and yesterday was 1. So I'm feeling really happy I was able to commit to that. Now I'm just going to work my way back up. Next week, I'm going to go 2. The week after that, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, just to really just commit to it. And I'm just looking forward to it. I'm feeling really good that I was able to stick to it. It was definitely more of a mentality mindset. There's definitely some days I got home where I was walking the dog where I was like, oh, I really don't want to go, but I was able to knock it out. So I'm feeling amped up and ready to go for today's podcast.
7 times, that's tough.
Yeah, I want to start off really, really strong, really hard, just to get back into the swing of things. So it was a lot easier as I got into the lower weeks, but working my way back up, I think might be a little bit more challenging.
Well, that's great. Yeah, it's great that you've done it, but I can get 4 in, but I can't even... I've definitely gotten 7 in before. I remember that during the pandemic, but it's tough. Nice job. Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
It is tough. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So, Adrian, I believe you're going first today, correct?
I think Eric might want to start us off. I'll go in the middle and then you're anchoring last. So, Eric, I'm really excited to hear what you have today.
Yeah. Well, so to our listeners, today we're doing another in our periodic series of Bring Your Own Topic Days. And this is where each of us prepares something that the others don't know in advance what the subject will be. And then we bring it and hopefully make it interesting, not only for one another, but especially for you. Today, the subject I'm bringing is the subject of long-term care insurance coverage. This is something which if you look at the statistics for the number of people over age 65 who will at some point for some duration need some amount of care, you realize, wow, this is not like that remote risk of maybe your house burning down or your car getting totaled. This is instead something that has a widespread impact on many, many families. Roughly half of all women over age 65 will need care of some duration at some age. And the average duration of that need is somewhere approaching, in their cases, depending on the studies that you'll look at, between 3 and 4 years. And the portion of that which would be provided by commercial solutions, meaning by some facility, let's say an assisted living facility or a long-term care facility of some kind, then for affluent people, that is predominantly our listeners, that is, there's a heavier reliance on that than resorting necessarily only to care provided by family members. For men, the numbers are both a little lower on both the incidence and on the duration, but it's still high. So when you hear these numbers about 70% of all people will need long-term care, first of all, I just want to let you know that's a little bit of an exaggeration, which is part of the problem of my, at least my reaction to much of the way in which long-term care insurance is discussed. But it is the case that if you do, let's say you're a married couple and you have, let's say 50% of women, roughly 40% of men, roughly, who would need this care for some duration, then the instances in which neither of the two members of that marriage would need it really is maybe around 30% or slightly lower than that. So at the family unit level for a married couple, that incidence is high.
Well, Eric, let me ask you a question. You had said that you felt the 70% is an exaggeration. Can you explain that further?
Yeah, to say that 70%, an individual's chance that they will need that care is 70%, that's a bit of an exaggeration. If you say a married couple's instance of one or both of them needing it, not knowing in advance which of the ones it might be, at the marital level, that's probably about 70%. That's a fair, roughly fair number. So with that, let's talk about then the costs of these things. So to have someone come into your home for 44 hours a week to provide home health care or a home health aide or homemaker services, today, it varies, of course, a lot from your state and from your city and so forth. Let's say Connecticut is going to be substantially more expensive than, let's say, Arkansas. But one rough number there that you could use would be about $50,000 a year or in that neighborhood for that kind of care. If you, of course, up that to around-the-clock care, then you're going to be covering roughly four times that cost or somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 a year. If instead you went into, let's say, an assisted living facility, that currently is about $50,000 or $60,000 a year. And there, of course, you have full-time staffing, but you're also being served by a number of people who are rotating around the clock and then are also serving other of your fellow residents in that facility. Memory care is similar. Then if you instead move to a skilled nursing facility, then those numbers jump about 50 to 100%. So let's say somewhere in the neighborhood of $90,000 to $100,000 a year for a semi-private room, a little bit more for a private room. Okay. With that then, with that as a backdrop, let's say that you are a guy and you are one of the 40% or so that would need this care, and you're roughly, on average, just a little shy of 3 years of need. You might have some care at home from family members for a year or a portion of a year. You might then have some help from someone brought in who does this for a living. Then you might move to an assisted living facility, or it might progress a little faster for you. I don't know. If you're a woman, maybe it's a little care at home, a little bit of time in an assisted living facility, maybe some time in a long-term care facility. So oftentimes when I'm looking at solutions for clients, I'm thinking in terms of 3 or 4 years for the guy, 4 or 5 years for the woman, and then looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of about, give or take, $5,000 or $6,000 a month, depending on how much of that burden that particular client might want to personally absorb. And I also look at having a cost of living adjustment. And I also look at having 90 days where you essentially self-insure at the beginning of that. Because if you're willing to self-insure for a period of that, at the outset of that time, then you'll probably do a little better. There's much, much more we could say about the actual elements of long-term care selection. But I thought I would be, one of the things that I was really wanting to address today was that many people buy or just make the decision to purchase long-term care on the basis of either fear or emotion. And many people also decide to not purchase on the basis of just a broad skepticism about long-term care in general, or a view that they're somehow invulnerable and therefore won't really need it. They'll be one of the few that won't need this care at all. And so it leads to, unfortunately, in many cases, prolonging this decision beyond the point at which it would perhaps be optimal from an analytical standpoint to make this decision. So I've looked at the cost to benefit ratio for starting a policy of this kind, And I'll talk about different policy types in just a moment. But starting this policy at the age of, let's say, 50, 55, 60, 65, and 70. And this is a bit of an over-exaggeration, but I will just say that's not a word. It's an exaggeration. You don't say over-exaggeration. So an exaggeration to say that it's true for everyone, but more or less, if you the inception of your policy is at about age 55, that gives the insurer time to have some confidence that they're going to be receiving premiums over a long enough period to give you a little bit of a break on the pricing. But it's also starting it late enough that you're not insuring a lot of years where you probably your probable need for that care is somewhat lower. So I'm just going to say if you're right now in that 50, 60 area, I would encourage you strongly to get with your advisor and take a look at this. Now, and if you're in 60 to 70 and you haven't done so, it's still not too late. And I'm going to show you an example of a client's analysis here in just a moment, which was something that we did for a single woman making this decision at her age 70, or is it 71, thereabouts. Okay, so what have the insurers done? Well, like most, your car insurance, your auto insurance, your medical insurance, most insurances that we think about are use it or lose it type insurances. And I think if you said, hey, yeah, I'm fine with the use it or lose it approach on my house. Why? Because, you know, I don't want my house to burn down so that I can feel like I scored a big payday on my home insurance. And I don't want to total my car so that I can feel like I scored a big payday on my auto insurance. But somehow or another, the psychology around long-term care insurance has grown up where people think, man, I don't want to spend all that money on long-term care insurance premiums of that use it or lose it variety and then wind up, what if I don't need it? I'll have laid out all that premium. That is so true. You will have laid out all that premium. But I want to show you some things that you should look at that don't make that quite so simple. Having said that, let me acknowledge that the insurers understand that psychology. And so many of the insurers have come up with a hybrid version, or at least some of them have. And what they've said is okay, you're concerned that if it should happen that you're in that minority of people that don't need this, then how about this? How about if we give you the option of if you need the care, you'll have a benefit. It won't be as great as the benefit as you would have received, at least for dollars of premium you've paid out from the traditional kind, but it'll still be a multiple of what you've put into the policy. On the other hand, if you pass away, rather than just saying, I lost it all, instead what we'll do is we'll provide a death benefit of some magnitude to those that you name as your beneficiary. Could be more, could be less, could be about the same as you put in. It varies from policy to policy. And then the third option that they offer as well is to say, yeah, but we recognize there are going to be some instances in which you might say, I looked like I'm not needing it. I'm also not really keen to wait until I pass away because to benefit my heirs with that. Could I reverse my decision and take the cash back out or some portion of it? And yes, so there is in many of these policies also that option that you can change your mind and retrieve some amount, all of, or even maybe a little more than you put into the policy to begin with. So that version we'll just broadly label a hybrid policy. And then the third type, and there are other types, but I'm just going to stop with the third type. The third type is just a conventional cash value life insurance policy, and they come in various varieties. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on that right now, but the way in which those work is that you can add a long-term care rider. And what does that rider do? That rider gives you the option, if you, of course, meet the qualifications, usually it's a chronic illness or a terminal illness or something of that nature, that your doctor will certify, then you can go to the insurer and say, hey, look, I know I've got this death benefit. Could you start paying that out to me prematurely now? I haven't passed away yet, but I'm going to start using some of the death benefit now for covering my costs. And so they'll maybe do, depending on how you structure the policy, 2%, 4% per month, whatever. All right. So now with that as a backdrop, and I covered that quickly because that's not really my main point. I just want you to understand that there are choices here. And the question then is, how do you go about choosing? And my contention is that unfortunately many people and unfortunately many advisors want to contain or confine this conversation to being essentially an emotional one. And unfortunately, especially those, and I don't mean to be too hard on my brethren in the insurance world, but there are also a lot, I would say, of instances in which people whose main thing is long-term care insurance, I think sometimes we'll turn the emotional key a little bit harder than others, or the emotional dial a little harder than some others will do. My general disposition in life is yes, we live in a world where we actually have emotions and we should think about some of the non-financial aspects of all of this. I, for example, love my policy because in large part, I don't know if my daughter's listening, I don't really relish the thought at some point later in my life that I would have to interrupt my daughter's lives and ask them to come take care of me. So, but that having been said, the analytical element of this is what's important to me. So I'm going to show a spreadsheet here that takes this conversation and moves it into what a good investment analysis would, or the approach that a good investment analyst would use to compare different sorts of investments in longer term investments with an unknown outcome, or at least a potential array of possible outcomes. How they would then model that investment decision. I think that's the same, that's useful to do the same thing with these long-term care policies. Before I do that, gentlemen, any questions or reactions?
I mean, I think you hit on a really big point, but go ahead, Roshan.
Overwhelming is what I'd say. And I'm familiar with what you're reviewing in the field. I just think it's a lot. What that to me shows is that anyone making this decision really needs to take some time to think it through, compare the alternatives that are out there. And as you had just said, use an analytical approach to make this decision.
Yes, I agree. Just shopping around, seeing what other options you have out there is just extremely important. And like Eric's mentioning, just what is your situation? What is the type of care you think you'll need? What's the probability of that? How does that really fit in your overall plan the best way possible, where maybe if you don't need it, it's still just, it works within your plan, doesn't derail it in any way. I think it's really important, but I'm really excited to see what you have to share right now, Eric.
Okay, great. So I'm going to those of our listeners, you might want to, at this point, if you can, switch over or come back later to the YouTube version, because I'm going to show you some graphs here. And this will, I think, help tell the story of what we're trying to do here. But before I do that, let me just say that the approach that I'm using here with clients is to lay the different choices out in a spreadsheet and show the pros and cons of different sorts of approaches so that they can see exactly what it is that we're talking about. But then it is to take it one step further and to use a particular mathematical approach known as internal rate of return analysis. What does that mean? Internal rate of return analysis looks at an uneven a flow of cash, both out and in. What are the flows? Paying premium out is an outflow. If you receive a death benefit, if that's how you you passed away still with the policy in place, that would be an inflow. If you instead used it for long-term care, that would be an inflow. Or if you instead changed your mind, that would be an inflow. And so, as you might remember from your math class in high school, when you do that, you have to say, well, what probability do I attach to each of those possible outcomes? So, for example, if I said, I'm going to go outside today and I'm going to bring an umbrella, there's some probability that it will rain, some probably that it won't. You're assigning a probability against the cost, so-called cost of actually carrying an umbrella, which is kind of annoying. Well, it's annoying for me. So in this case, we're going to assign probabilities to each of those particular cases. So let me share my screen here, and then we'll talk about this spreadsheet. This is the spreadsheet that I wanted to share with you. So here's Jane Doe. Jane is coming. She's 71 here, coming up on her 72nd birthday later this year. And she has been saying, okay, well, I think it's finally time that I do this. So what you can see here is I've got company A, company B, C, and D. Company B and C within the hybrid form offer this particular client the option of paying one premium right up front and getting it all over with, or paying on an as-you-go basis for the first 10 years. That's this middle section you're looking at here. Those are the hybrid policies. And the top section is the traditional insurance. There it's pay and pay and pay and pay and pay until you don't want the policy any longer or you pass away. And then in the bottom case, it is pay and pay and pay and pay until you pass away or you start accessing that benefit for your long-term care. So I'm going to highlight this this one column that I'm going to highlight right now, column L. One super simple way of looking at this is to say, okay, if I put a cost of living adjustment on this particular benefit, growing from essentially $6,000 a month until such a time as this client turned 85, then how much would that benefit be at age 85 if this client needed that benefit for 4 years or thereabouts? Well, or as long as at least the policy would provide that benefit, say 48 to 50 months in these different policies cases. So what that shows is the amount of benefit or the size of the pool of benefits that would be there, and next to that, the cost that this client would incur until that point. We can then say the yield to the cost, if the long-term care feature of that policy was used, what is that yield on the cost? Well, you can see in the first case for company A, it's roughly $3 of a pool of $3 for every dollar that she had put in over time. And farther down, you can see, the pool of benefits is maybe between $1.34 to $2.61 for every dollar that she had put in. And the bottom case, it would be $1.67 of benefits for every dollar that she had put in. But here's the thing, that's not really a truly fair way of comparing this. Because in some cases, you put the money in all up front, and in other cases, you put that money in more gradually. The latter, all else being equal, would normally produce a higher actual benefit or a return on one's investment. So the more proper way to look at this is as an investment would an investor or an investment analyst at least would look at this. And so in this particular case, if we looked at the internal rate of return based on a variety of possible outcomes, then we're in a better position to make a comparison here. So what is that set of possible outcomes? And any client would have to make these assessments for themselves. But what I've done on this next spreadsheet is to show that on the far left side here, we're looking at the traditional policy. And we're assuming that this client would start this requirement for care at age 81 and would have it for 4 years and then pass away at age 85. And so that would mean paying premium on the policy until age 81 and then starting to receive 4 years of benefit using that cost of living adjustment feature. But what we've done is I've discounted in this case the inflated value or the cost of living adjusted value of that $6,000 a month, or in today's money, $72,000 a year, and I've discounted it by 50%. Why? Because we're working from the assumption that she, being a female over age 65, has only about a 50% chance of needing that care. And so it's conceivable that she could indeed pass away without calling on that benefit at any point in her life. There's a 25% chance, we're saying, that she might change her mind. But since this policy offers no way to retrieve that capital, if she changes her mind, then there's zero paid off in that case. And finally, if she were to pass away with the policy, this also doesn't offer a death benefit. And so there would be zero death benefit there, discounted by this 25% probability assumption that we're using here. And each of the other policy types are modeled throughout this spreadsheet. We just go along and look at the expected return under the probability weightings associated with each of those different designs. So we bring the internal rate of return back into this table. And what we see is, despite the fact that this client said, I really don't like that traditional insurance approach, in this case, the internal rate of return on that particular approach, given the set of assumptions that we used there, is by far the highest of all the internal rates of return here. Meaning, in this case, for every dollar she puts in, especially because it's gradually done, and then the magnitude of that pool of benefits, even though she would get no option for pulling money out and no option to receive a beneficiary distribution if she passed away, nevertheless, even under those impositions of those assumptions, there's an over 8% internal rate of return for her, even starting this at age 71, which is, I think, remarkable. Where you also see in this case is that the second highest return model here is in the permanent life insurance policy, where in this particular case, by virtue of the fact that she would have the option of tapping some cash value if she wished to, or she would have the option of a death benefit if she never needed the care, then in this case, that internal rate of return is about 5%. The hybrid forms are substantially lower, which isn't to say that will be true in all clients' cases, and because there are different clients with different sets of assumptions. But nevertheless, I would say this is the approach that I would advocate your advisor use with you in helping you make a decision about, or at least incorporating this analysis into your decision-making process about which of these solutions that you might use.
Yeah, and Eric, so we compared the three, the traditional, the hybrid, and using permanent life insurance. And when I've done these analysis in the past, you just made a great point that it does vary by individual, but I have most frequently seen the traditional tend to have the highest internal rate of return, which to me makes sense if you just think about it with the basics. One is it's built for long-term care, and two, just the premium tends to be so much higher for the hybrid. Right. So without running this analysis, as I said, I have run this before for clients, though, I tend to find that the traditional works, and the third being the life insurance. Well, the fact that it's a life insurance product primarily and not built primarily for long-term care, you know, the other reason. So it kind of made sense to me that that would frequently be the case. Have you seen many instances, or can you think of any examples where the traditional does not have the highest IRR?
Yeah, I have seen on some younger people, and particularly where we had seen some of the carriers offering a bigger development of the underlying cash value that you could walk away with, which I call, you know, the walk away option. That walk away money option had been higher previously, and as a result, some of the internal rates of return on some of the carriers under some of the slow pay models seemed to work out pretty well too. But I would agree with the point you've made. In this case, for this client at least, looking in column K, the traditional approach over the life of this, you know, the assumed life of needing to pay these premiums would be $180,000, essentially $182,000, in exchange for a $560,000 pool of benefits. That's just so much lower than on any of the hybrid forms. In one of the hybrid forms in particular, even the lowest cost of those is making an upfront outlay of $223,000. When you do that all up front, there's a huge opportunity cost of that capital that could be working for you and growing over time.
Yeah. And I've got one final question. And then Adrian, if you've got questions, jump in. If not, we can jump to your topic. But it's in this example, Eric, the person's 72 years old. And then you had mentioned how sometimes you've seen a better IRR in younger clients. If you had to say an age range, what's the earliest I should be looking at this? And at what point am I probably of the age where it's just not worth it because the cost goes up so much?
I would say if you're age 50 and you're more conservative as an investor, your opportunity cost of parting with premium dollars starting in your early 50s is a lower opportunity cost. Meaning, hence, it's more attractive to get started on it then than would be the case if you were more of an aggressive investor, where parting with premium dollars starting in your early 50s, I believe, would present too big a barrier to your being able to deploy that capital and have it grow first before you start calling on it. But for all intents and purposes, the moderate to moderate aggressive investor, I would probably say, the optimal sweet spot for this is in your mid-50s. So be looking by your mid-50s at these choices. If you get to, let's say, 75, I think you've missed the boat, and you really need to really think hard about what other options you might have. By that point in time, hopefully your portfolio has developed to such a level that you'll be able to absorb that anyway. But I would just urge you to think about doing this in your mid-50s. Let's just say that.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Adrian, let's move to your topic today.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about the psychology of money. And I think this is a really interesting topic for a lot of different reasons, because it really does impact people's personal finance, wealth creation, investing strategies. So I'm just really excited to get into this topic today. For people that aren't familiar with this field of study, this is where you look at different attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs people have around money that really impact their overall financial decisions. And I think that's just one of the biggest themes that I'm going to be drawing on here, because looking at people's different, what they call the term money mindset, can really show how people make day-to-day decisions, how they invest for the future or on the short term. So this is why this is just really important to really understand what this field of study is taking a look at here. So I mentioned the term money mindset. This is where someone has a set of beliefs or attitudes that they have towards money that have really been shaped by a number of factors, whether it's their upbringing, their culture, education, or just overall their personal experiences. So this is really important because this does have a really profound impact on how individuals make investment decisions, how they make financial decisions, whatever it may be. With what Eric talked about too, this might even go into how people decide on whether or not they should get long-term care insurance or the type of insurance they should get. So it really does boil into a lot of different realms in people's personal financial life. So I think it's just really important. You guys have any questions or want me to expand on anything until I get into the different money mindset examples? Yes. So the first money mindset example is a generosity mindset. And this is when an individual prioritizes giving to others and making a positive impact in the world through their financial resources. They believe that wealth should be used to make a difference in others' lives and overall the world. They can also prioritize giving to charity and helping other social responsibilities, whether it's in their community or whatever stage of life that they're in. So that's a money mindset that I want to start off with. What do you guys think?
I love that. I think that you do see that. I'm interested to hear that in contrast with some of the other personalities that you're going to describe. But I certainly think that you do see that in some people. There's just a very strong impulse to give. I've got a client who has, they make a really great living, but it's 20% of their income right off the top is given to charitable causes each year. And I have other clients where they're not as, they don't have an income of that magnitude, but about a third of what they make, they off the top goes out the door for charitable causes. And I think, man, these are hardcore givers. I love it.
Yeah, that's it exactly lines up with this type of mindset. The next one I have on my list is a scarcity mindset. And this mindset sometimes is really driven by fear or anxiety of not having enough in the future to meet some basic day-to-day needs. So this will be an individual who thinks that they really need to save a lot in order to meet their goals or whatever it may be that that's involved in their daily life. And this could also lead them to avoid taking certain risks and can limit their overall ability to create wealth if they want to really take a more conservative approach. So that's another mindset too that I want to discuss and expand further on today as well. The third one is a growth mindset. This is an individual who believes that their financial situation can improve with effort and learning, and that they see if they are involved in any financial setbacks, that they really deem this as an opportunity for them to grow and learn and focus on developing their financial knowledge and skills to achieve their goals. The next money mindset I have on my list, this one's called money worship. This is a money mindset that's often driven by a belief that money is the key to happiness and success. This is where an individual really values certain material possessions and wealth accumulation over pretty much anything else. This can be very beneficial sometimes if you wanted to achieve certain goals or certain purchases that you want, but sometimes too, it might lead to an unfulfilling or maybe sometimes an unsustainable lifestyle. So that's something also to make note for one of the mindsets. And the last one is financial empowerment. This is where an individual's mindset really believes that they have control over their financial situation and they can take actions to improve it today. This is where an individual sometimes prioritizes financial education and empowerment to develop their skills, their resources, whatever it may be, to, again, just to achieve whatever goals that they have in their life. So those were five money mindsets. There's a lot more, but those are five that I really want to address and expand on a little bit more today that I thought were really interesting that I never heard of.
So would you recap the five? So there's generosity, fear, growth, worship, and one more. What's that?
So generosity mindset, scarcity mindset, growth mindset, money worship mindset, and financial empowerment mindset. And like I said, there's a lot more, but those are the five that I pulled.
Yeah. And Adrian, did you see this at all in your research? I read a book years ago that went into, and it didn't use the same terminology, but it went to, the different money mindsets or psychology behind it. And it really tied back to what the person observed growing up. Did you see anything like that where the causes for how someone falls in one of these groups?
So I would say what I've seen from my research, it's a culmination of things. So yes, their personal experience, that would more so be their upbringing, be a big one. The next one would be education as well. That plays a vital role in it. And I guess this does correlate or connect with the upbringing, but a person's culture as well plays a big role in it. So those would be the main things that I think really create somebody's money mindset.
Yeah. Did you see any research that indicated it from a sort of a happiness measures of any kind? Because I know Roshan had done this, secrets to happiness study before. And so did you see any sort of correlation between one or more of those mindsets and a higher or lower degree of happiness?
So not for any specific mindset, but I'm going to go on to steps later on in my discussion about this that really will show some of the benefits on really evaluating what kind of money mindset you have and maybe fine-tuning, making adjustments, and really evaluating to see how you should maybe move on or change in the future to really have a better sense of security. So I'll dive a little bit deeper into that after my another section that I want to discuss too is how the psychology of money really impacts investing. And this is a very big one, which we've actually discussed on previous episodes on the Retirement Lifestyle Show. And like I mentioned before, how the psychology of money really has a significant impact on how people really make their investment decisions. Because this is where certain attitudes, behaviors around money can really strongly impact on how you invest, what type of investments you look at, or whether you stay away from investing altogether. It really boils down to the own individual in this case. Where we can go back to that scarcity money mindset that I talked before. This would be somebody that's very risk averse. They really prefer conservative investments, or like I said, they really are staying away from investing altogether because of the fear of loss in their overall situation. So that's something that you need to consider as well. Or the opposite end would be a growth-minded mindset person. This is a person that will take on and pursue higher returns, which we know if you're pursuing high returns, that means you have to take on a greater degree of risk. And it's also important to make note, it's great having high returns, that's fantastic, we all love that, but this could also sometimes lead to overconfidence where you're taking on a lot of excess risk that you might not need to, and you might experience some loss. So that's also something that is really important, what I'm really trying to drive home with this, where you really need to evaluate the type of money mindset that you have, especially when it comes to investing, because you could succumb to certain classic investing pitfalls that might really impact your overall situation. So that's something that people really need to make note of, and that's just really important too. Another thing that draws really big into this section is emotions. Emotions, sometimes we love to say, yeah, you have to take emotions out of investing. That's the best way you can do it. But as we all know, at the end of the day, we are human. We have emotions. And especially when it comes to investing, knowing what type of person you are when it comes to investing is really, really important for you to get those consistent returns, for you to manage your risk and overall hit those goals that you really want to get into. So before I move on to the steps and ways that you can maybe evaluate your money mindset, do you guys have any questions or want to expand on anything that I touched so far?
Just to highlight how important, I was thinking exactly where you're heading, that understanding what money mindset you fall into would help you to do a better job managing your portfolio.
Yeah, it's exactly right, Roshan. That's definitely a really big one that I want to let our listeners and viewers understand today. So I'm going to move on to this next section that I have, are steps to develop a healthy, positive money mindset. And the first one I really touched on, this is where you really need to identify the current money mindset that you have. This is really important, like I talked about, especially when it comes to investing. Because becoming aware of your current beliefs and your attitude towards money can really help see what the best course of action for you are. And reflecting on your upbringing, your experience, and your belief around money is a really good way to identify and evaluate the type of money mindset to have, to see if you really want to make some changes or want to improve on anything that you're currently doing right now. And once you evaluate the money mindset that you have, start challenging some of those limiting beliefs that I had for those money mindsets. Challenge any negative thoughts that you have or any patterns that you have, and maybe try a step in the other direction. For example, if you're somebody that really falls in the scarcity mindset bucket, maybe make a little bit of adjustment, see how it changes. You don't have to do anything drastic like change your overall investment portfolio. But if you're somebody that's saving on a day-to-day operation or in your day-to-day life, maybe see what will happen if you change your spending for 1 week and then change it from there. So really evaluating the mindset that you have and maybe challenging and trying something new is a good step in the right direction to having a healthy and positive money mindset. The next one is practicing gratitude. And this is a really big one. It's always really important to really focus on sometimes what you have, because it's very common for people to compare their situation to other people's situation or constantly looking at your goals, but you're not really focusing on the goals that you've already accomplished that you spend so much time doing. Practicing gratitude is a really good way to really strengthen a money mindset that you have, especially when it comes to your financial life. It's an extremely important step to really make those changes that you need to do. The next is seek out financial education. This is just a really big one, because improving your financial knowledge and literacy can make a really positive impact on your life and can really help make more informed decisions, especially when it comes to the investing space. The more research, the more data you can gather can really help put the odds in your favor, like we say, when it comes to investing. So that's a really big one. And then the last step is surround yourself with positive influences. This could be friends, mentors, anybody that has a really positive and healthy relationship when it comes to money can really help maybe see the mindset that you have. And I know I talked about it's not good to compare, but really just broaden your horizons, meet new people, and they can really help you evaluate and see where you want to be if you want to make some substantial changes to the mindset you have or the opinion you have around money. So that's a really big one when it comes to the steps.
Yeah, I really like that one of surrounding yourself with positive influences. I think that transcends not only finance, but pretty much anything.
Exactly. Yeah. And doesn't always have to correlate directly to finances as well or money. It can be a lot of different things.
Oh, Adrian, I love this topic. Do you have more to say?
Well, the last thing I want to just really mention here and why I really chose this topic is really some of the positive aspects that having a healthy money mindset can have on your personal life and also just your financial life. Like I mentioned before, it can really improve financial decision-making, where you're making those informed decisions and you're really staying away from being impulsive or irrational when it comes to decision-making. It really can help you stick to a set of principles, which is really important. It can also give you a really greater degree of confidence and really help you avoid any anxiety that you have towards money and overall reduce your stress that you have towards it. That's just really important, having a sense of confidence, especially when it comes to the investing landscape as well. The next one is it can increase your financial success. Having a positive and a very abundant mindset can really open up an individual to new opportunities for growth, wealth creation, and really making the best calculated risk decisions for your overall position. And another thing too that having a strong, healthy money mindset can do is it can also improve relationships. It can make you very collaborative when it comes to your money mindset. It can improve your communications with whoever it may be, whether it's a partner, family member, friend, a spouse, whatever it is. It can really overall improve your relationship. So really changing your money mindset or improving it or really evaluating and see where you stand can really help you achieve certain financial successes you want in your life and give you that sense of security and maybe in some cases improve certain relationships that you have in your life as well. And that's why I thought this was a really interesting discussion that I wanted to have today to really point out to listeners and viewers how this can play a really pivotal role, not just in your personal financial life, but also in your overall life in general.
So Adrian, I didn't, you know, of course, as I said, when we introduced this subject to our audience today, I had no idea this is what you were going to be talking about when we turned on the cameras today. But I regard this as one of the really most fundamental questions of human happiness right here. Being able to have an attitude toward money that is healthy is makes all the difference. I think there is a money has a power over us, and we have to look for ways to break the hold of money on us, which isn't to say that money is bad. I think it's the succumbing to the power of money to distort our choices and to distort our actions. I think that's the way in which we get trapped. So anyway, thank you so much for raising this subject.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that, Eric. And there's just so much I want to expand more on. I can probably do 10 episodes on this topic alone. It's a very deep, thought-provoking discussion. And it's something that I don't think we really have really touched on. So it was something new, something that I really didn't know too much about. But once I've just started reading more and researching more, it really does transcend even outside of money as well, like Roshan mentioned as well, where it can really impact a lot of different aspects of your life. So it's something that I probably will return to at another point.
Well, I'm not going to promise to put this in the show notes, but I will just make a reference to one experience that was really helpful to me that for those clients that are looking for some way to sort of reshape or reorient themselves in terms of their money mindset. There's something offered by Generous Giving. It's an organization that's, I think, funded by the McClellan Foundation. But they have a 22-hour experience with a group of people. Usually it's done as a retreat. There's no pitch. There's no solicitation of donations. It's just trying to help people grapple with this sort of thing. It's called the Journey of Generosity. And I would encourage anybody who has not been on that, had that 22-hour experience of the Journey of Generosity, do that with a group of people. And I think you'll have your outlook dramatically shifted, and it'll be a source of real joy and encouragement to you.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for that, Eric. I'll definitely check that out for sure.
Excellent. Now I'll jump into my topic for today. We either save the best or worst for last. Only time will tell. So I've been reading and seeing a lot about de-dollarization, which is the dollar losing its reserve currency status. So we've got a few things that have been going on about this. And I wonder, is it underreported and should we be looking out for it? Or is it underreported because I'm looking too much into something that's nothing? So just give you an idea of what's going on. And gentlemen, I'd love to just hear your thoughts on the topic. So the dollar has been the official reserve currency since 1944. In the last month, roughly, China and Russia have agreed to settle their transactions using the Chinese yuan. The Saudi Arabia has agreed with China to do the same. And the emerging markets, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are exploring building their own currency. So not all of this is brand new. Just with the sanctions the government put on Russia a year ago with their attack on Ukraine, they've been expanding their use of the yuan. But I'm wondering, and I have more data and more points to share. But gentlemen, am I looking too much into something? I'm just wondering if this is there something we need to do as investors or as a country about this, or is this a non-story and I'm just overreacting? Any initial thoughts to that question?
I do have some reactions. So first of all, I would say, insofar as the dollar has served as you pointed out, as the unofficial reserve currency for most nations around the world, it's been considerably more stable as a store of value than many other currencies have been. And so in many parts of the developing world, China included, actually, reliance on the dollar as a component of the sovereign wealth of those nations and holding dollars has been deemed to be a useful thing. If they're not holding dollars, then they're holding oftentimes dollar denominated bonds. And so with that, that being the case, then there has been an immense worldwide demand for dollars other than just citizens of the United States wanting to use it as a means of exchange here. And what that has done is it has made the dollar, anything where there's a demand, high demand for something, all else being equal, assuming constant supply, then what that does is it, relative to other substitutes, it drives the value of that higher. So there's been, for a long period over this stage that you described, these decades now, a relatively strong dollar. What does a strong dollar do? A strong dollar makes it more affordable for those that operate entirely in a dollar-denominated framework, namely the U.S. citizen, to purchase goods that are produced elsewhere in other currencies. And so that has made it possible for the United States to import a lot of goods and services, but mostly goods, from other parts of the world. If the dollar, though, conversely, it's made it harder for U.S. manufacturers in some ways to then be able to have people whose base currency is something else against that strong dollar to then want to buy our products, because insofar as they're dollar denominated, they just become prohibitively expensive compared to some other substitutes. So if you lower the demand for the dollar by turning to other reserve currencies, or at least allowing a diversification of possible reserve currencies, then what that does is it takes some pressure of the demand pressure off the dollar, lower, all else being equal, allows it to, in relationship to other currencies, grow less valuable, which then means that from a standpoint, it becomes harder for the U.S. citizen to buy imports as affordably, but conversely, it makes it more affordable for others to buy U.S. goods and services and therefore boosts the export capacity of the country. So this is, by the way, a common strategy for countries oftentimes, to the extent that they're able, is to deliberately devalue their currencies in order to boost exports and thereby to have inflows from outside the world. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily a bad thing if it happens. That's a different question as to whether I think it's probable, but I'll save that comment.
Yeah, and so the argument against that it's probable is that you need to have, in addition to the currency, you need the U.S. system. That meaning you've got your assets aren't going to be seized, and people are definitely still concerned about that if they were to go to the yuan or there are other concerns where you just don't have the whole system in place. But as you said previously, well, if you're trading in dollars, you need dollars. So that increases demand. So they would hold dollars at the very least for settlement of trade. And if you're not, you don't need it as much, causing a weakening of the dollar. Right. So balancing that out, and what I've been looking at and reading and researching has been trying to say, all right, is this, what move does the investor make in a situation like this? And the, haven't gotten a clear answer, but the general argument was, well, you'd want to then have some investments in what you think would be the reserve currency. And so if yuan's not it, just because of the way their government is set up, then the other thing I've seen, well, is the Indian rupee the next option? Would rupees potentially be that reserve currency? Now, India's been trading with Russia and you know, settling in rupees versus dollars. So that's been happening. They've agreed to settle in, you know, their own currencies with Chinese trade. So I don't know, as I said, this could be the best or worst for last. I'm always looking for practical uses for what we discuss on our show. It could be the best if there is some kind of shift, and then this may be just an opportunity for you to go research some other countries where you put a portion of your portfolio, especially for the U.S. investors. The counter to that might also be true, where if you look at your portfolio and you focus on your U.S. companies not having global businesses, more U.S.-based businesses, that might be another approach. I don't have an answer here, just some thoughts and ideas on where you can be looking for the opportunity. But then I also wonder, just on a global political scale where things have been going, is this a cause for concern? A lot of talk out there that this is a response to the quote-unquote weaponization of the dollar, that being the sanctions the U.S. government has put on Russia after their attack on Ukraine, you know, freezing dollar assets, keeping them off of the SWIFT system, which was set up by the U.S. for international trade. So once again, a lot of questions, not necessarily a lot of answers. But if either of you have anything to add to enhance my focus in research or other areas to look, or if you say this is noise, you know, take it off your plate and don't spend any time on it, I'm open to that as well. As I said, I don't have the answers, just a lot of questions.
I'm not going to say that, Roshan. I love the topic, actually. I would say just the way my reasoning is flowing as I'm responding in real time here to you is that in terms of investment decision-making, it would make me say, okay, I do want to have then, to whatever extent I think it's useful to have some currency currency component to the overall asset mix, then I would probably want to hold some now currencies other than the US dollar. Having said that, I think I would also want to then be scrutinizing now, does that have a result of incentivizing, not day one, but over some period of time, does that incentivize more American manufacturing to come back home? There's been other reasons for that, but even more so, because now if they can become exporters and it's becoming, all else being equal, cheaper to produce goods here and then prepare them for export, to win those yuan away, those highly valuable yuan now away from other purchasers worldwide. Yeah, maybe that's an investment direction. Having said that, I do think one of the points that you made, the financial infrastructure, the institutional infrastructure of the U.S. dollar denominated world is quite robust, and that I say that knowing full well that, because we did an episode on this 2-3 weeks back, that yes, are there some anxiety levels right now about the stability of some regional banks? I think that's fading, but yes, of course, we observed that with Silicon Valley Bank and the Signature Bank and First Republic and such. But the nevertheless, I would say the institutional framework here is so strong. There's just no match for that in the yuan-denominated world.
And they are apparently trying, like they created their own version of the SWIFT system, but that was in 2015, right? So the China is trying, and I do wonder though. That's what's the recent headlines have been. It's really been China leading this de-dollarization charge, but. When I saw in my research the fact that, you know, the world's not necessarily going to like the infrastructure of China to make it a reserve currency, I mean, maybe I'm viewing this from a U.S. perspective, but that resonates with me, right? But then when they talk about, well, you've got another democratic nation with a large population just south of China, yeah, India, that there's potentially an argument there. Now that economy is not big enough now, so I don't think this is a question or an issue to resolve today, but being a long-term focused investor, that's where I'd say, well, is there something you do today just looking 10 years down the road? For anyone listening, if you've got greater insight or thoughts on this, please feel free to share it with us. You know how to reach us. Our information's in the show notes in the episode. You can go to the website, Retirement Lifestyle Show. We'd love the conversation and additional information on it, but just something for you to think about and do your own research as I continue doing mine. So we talked about three topics today, just on a large scale. We talked about long-term care and using an analytic, almost investor's perspective on making your decision there. We talked about the money mindset, and knowing what your mindset is can help you to be a better planner, investor, and make better financial decisions. And finally, if de-dollarization is something, or if it's noise, you've got better conclusions on the first two than the third. But we're here to get you thinking. And we appreciate you joining us. Remember, you've got the power to create the retirement you want. We hope joining us helps you in your journey. Keep making smart decisions and investing in your future. This has been the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through Arete Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither Arete Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of Arete Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through Arete Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and securities through Arete Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance by Jason Shaw and Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube audio library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.